I think the honeymoon phase only lasts a certain amount of time. And because I don't think it's real, I think it's fantasy. And as the relationship develops, usually as it becomes more intimate, we again see people warts and all. And it's so painful when people can see our deepest wounds, but it's so fulfilling when they can love us anyway.
Hey guys, I'm Ashley Dawn Rivard, and you are now Into the Dawn, a provocative podcast that looks at all things taboo, such as suicide, grief, sex, addictions, and more. Each week, I talk with experts who successfully investigate their areas of interest. And if you like what you hear, please remember to subscribe. Lauren Dummett Schock is a licensed marriage and family therapist, certified sex addiction therapist, certified sex therapist, and trauma specialist. She is the clinical director and co-founder of Triune Therapy Group in Brentwood, Los Angeles, a group practice that specializes in treating trauma and addiction, as well as sex and relationships from a holistic perspective. Thank you, Lauren, for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is so much fun.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this topic, and you're so well-versed in so many areas.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, this is such a prevalent, I don't want to call it issue, I guess, like issues or, I mean, line of work you're doing.
Well, thank you.
You know, there's never a shortage,
no.
I would assume.
Well, and I think also just the way technology is evolving, I think that was one of the things you had talked about was intimacy and mm-hmm. connection and how important that is for us as a society. We're relational beings.
Yes.
But with evolving technology, it kind of takes out the connection piece with
Absolutely.
A lot of people.
And with all of your expertise, like in addiction and with just being a marriage and family therapist, and with all your therapy in general, would you say that there is a common theme of perhaps like a lack of intimacy people are feeling either
Absolutely.
With themselves
I mean,
or others?
First of all, I have heard addiction defined as an intimacy disorder or an attempt to control intimacy. But also I've heard it said that the opposite of addiction is connection. So I definitely think there's a huge intimacy component. I think when people are using substances, essentially they're using them in order to feel okay in their body.
Right.
Whether they've had overt trauma, which is something that's like really obvious, like being raped or held at gunpoint, or covert trauma, which is more developmental or attachment or relational trauma from their childhood. And so I think frequently people are just wanting to feel okay in their skin. And so often they're seeking something, and the voice of addiction is often like, I need, I need, I need, which is why it's so common for people to switch addictions. But essentially, if we can't self-regulate, which means being able to regulate our emotions and our nervous system so that we can feel safe and calm in our bodies, if we can't feel that way with ourselves, it's really hard to be present and ultimately to have intimacy with another human being.
Yeah. What does intimacy look like then? Like true intimacy?
Well, I love that little catchphrase, like into see me. So when I think about intimacy, it's about really revealing yourself and letting yourself be seen by another, like warts and all. And not trying to just have them see a piece of you, but all of you. And that requires a lot of vulnerability. And that is really scary. I think it touches on our most like primitive survival instincts and the need to be accepted and loved. You know, if a mother doesn't like swaddle and like touch and love her baby, the baby will die of failure to thrive. So I think it goes back to like our basic core. And so that's why I think that fear of intimacy sometimes is so profound. I know people that are so brave and have done all these things, but like intimacy is probably one of the scariest things that people can face.
Do you think that this could be, is the word sexist maybe, of like with men? I see, you know, men who are just go-getters and mm-hmm. they can do anything, and they could go out and mm-hmm. you know, build businesses and mm-hmm. travel and do extreme things. Do you think there's part of them that is running from intimacy?
Well, that's a really good question. And I actually don't think it's sexist. I think part of it has to do with toxic masculinity and how we're socialized. I will just speak about this country, but I think men are raised to be tough and to not cry. And so talking about feelings often is not like a strong point for men or something they're comfortable with. I don't know whether that's innate or the way we're socialized. I think most of it has to do with the way we're socialized. And so I think if we're letting ourselves be fully seen, that's about sharing and sharing your feelings and your thoughts. And that is not something that has been honored and encouraged in men in our society. So yes, I think because of that, they're often, I don't know if running from it, but often very uncomfortable with it because it threatens their identity as a man.
And I would say, I mean, I've just noticed, I don't think women, not all women, but I'll say maybe in the older paradigm of relationships is a woman also has to stand for that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
If she meets a man at that level, but she's always miserable and complaining,
right?
You know?
Well, I think ultimately in relationships, it's not, someone once said to me, like, don't make him your everything because he'll inevitably fail you and then you'll resent him. And I was like, wow, that was so profound. It's really up to us to get our needs met. You know, we're only responsible for our own happiness. And if someone can't meet our needs, it's up to us to advocate for that or to get our needs met somewhere else. For example, if your husband doesn't like to go to the ballet, not surprising, but then maybe you need to do that with your friends. But it's important. We all have needs and wants, and those are important. And I think those are important to being satisfied in a relationship.
As a therapist for relationships, do you, if it is our job to meet our own needs, is there non-negotiables then?
So when I say it's, I don't think it's our responsibility to meet our own needs because I think there's some needs that we can't meet on our own. Like maybe the need for affection, like hugging myself just isn't the same as getting a hug from someone I see as like a support. But it's up to me to advocate for my needs. So if I'm in a relationship and that's something I need and they're not giving me that, then I need to be able to talk about that. And whether we can come to some type of arrangement or I need to get that need met somewhere else, or maybe we just decide we're not a good fit because this person can't meet my needs.
Okay. Yeah.
I recently just talked to one of my friends. He's a gay man and he had this boyfriend and they were like, they seemed like the perfect couple and they were so in love. And the last time I talked to him, he said they broke up and I was so sad to hear that. And he said, you know, I just had to be true to myself. And the truth was he wasn't meeting my needs and I don't know that he was capable of that. And what he meant was like his needs for intimacy and affection and all of that. And I thought, wow, that's so brave to be able to stand up for yourself that way. Because a lot of times we end up dismissing our own needs. Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with fear, like fear that we're not going to get that.
The clients you see then with sex, how important really is that to a relationship? Is that number one? Or is that, is intimacy actually really what people are want? And then sex is the icing on the cake.
It's so interesting because I just was meeting with a patient who they essentially has like the perfect relationship, but there's some issues that are creating problems for them sexually. And that was his question, like, how important is that? And I would have to say that it is very individual. Like each individual has different needs. For some people, sex is very important, but not for everyone. But what I would say is what is the meaning of sex for you? So for example, if the meaning of sex for you is connection, then that could be one way to connect, but there might be many other ways. So I would say that like, it really depends on what your needs are. Not, you might be with someone who's not really that into sex and you might not be either. And that doesn't mean you can't have an extremely satisfying, fulfilling relationship. So I think it really is based on what each person needs and not subscribing to what your relationship should look like. So we should be having sex this much, or if he really loved me, he'd want to have sex with me more. Like everybody is different. Everybody has different needs and wants.
What is then one of the number one issues that you see couples for? Is there a higher something going on that you see?
Well, I definitely think that communication is a huge one, because I think ultimately people tend, the thing is people defend themselves when they feel attacked. And when we're triggered, we often don't express ourselves in an ideal way. So for example, if I'm, you say something that triggers me, I might regress until my like angry teenager, mm-hmm. or probably some time in my life where something happened that I was much younger. And it's a similar dynamic. And often it's like something that happened with in your family of origin. But then I might react in a way that is rather immature and defensive. And then that person feels attacked and they get defensive. So I do so much work with people on communication and really coming from a place that wrong, right, or indifferent, this is just my experience. And if we're going to have intimacy, I need to be able to share it with you. I don't need to make you wrong. For example, when I try to talk to you and you're watching TV and you're ignoring me, you're not bad for doing that. There's nothing wrong with that, actually. But for me, it triggers me because it reminds me, and I'm just using an example, of when my dad would be constantly watching TV and I could never get him to play with me when I was a child. I could never get attention. And so if I'm not able to communicate that, I might just act that anger out. And, you know, my partner might be so confused and just, you know, so I think there's a lot of that that goes on. It's like really being able to communicate what's happening. Why are we hurt? And recognize that, oh, my partner's hurting, instead of going into like defending ourselves against being wrong. And so I see like such beautiful shifts when people can do that, but it's really difficult because it requires us to be really vulnerable, you know, to say, I felt really hurt when you did that, you know, mm-hmm. instead of just getting mad.
Would you say that is a key, though, to having a successful relationship?
Communication?
Yeah.
Well, I know many people that have, not many, I shouldn't say that, but I have heard of people having successful relationships that don't even speak the same language. However, I'm guessing they have a different way of communicating. And so I don't necessarily know that it has to do with language, but I definitely think the way we communicate is really important. Yes. Betrayal is another one.
I was going to ask you that is how much infidelity? Is that betrayal you're talking about?
Yeah. So when we talk about relational betrayal, infidelity is one of them,
okay.
a big one. Yeah. But it can also be financial betrayal and just more subtle betrayals. You know, for example, I share with you something so intimate and so vulnerable, and then we're fighting and you use that against me. Or, you know, I'm having a really serious problem and I've been so vulnerable and talk to you about it. And then you go tell everyone. So I think there's many different forms of betrayal, but I think financial and infidelity are two of the big ones.
Why do you think people stray from relationships?
Well, I think there's many different reasons that people stray from relationships. And actually, if you're interested in that topic, I highly recommend Esther Perel's.
Love her. Know her,
Why am I blanking on it?
It's the...
She has Mating in Captivity. And then State of Affairs. That's what it's called. And it's fascinating analysis of why people stray. I think there's so many different reasons. But ultimately, I think it's about not having our needs met. And when we're not able to communicate or work through that with our partner, then we also might look to someone else to meet that. And a lot of times it's just for attention. Because the truth is we get... When we're in a relationship with an intimate partner, we stop seeing them as an individual who might need attention. We just become, we take them for granted.
Do you think it's possible to have, you know, longevity in relationships?
I do, absolutely. But I think it takes work. So, you know, people think, you know, to support a family, you have to go to work and make money, and it's hard. It's not comfortable. It's strenuous. To maintain your car, you have to take it to get serviced and do all these things. And just like anything, we have to do work to maintain a relationship. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it happens naturally. Okay. I mean, to be honest, like when you have a roommate, like even I've had best friends as roommates and like they've remained my best friends, but like it's inevitable that you're going to fight with your roommate. It's hard to be in relationship with other people. We're so different.
Yeah. When you're that close. I luckily have good roommates. They're never around. And I never,
Well, no, I guess I use that because often we develop an intimate relationship. Absolutely. And I think anytime intimacy is involved, it becomes, we have differences.
Yeah. And then like you were saying, when conflict arises,
right,
it's so challenging because that's when you're starting to get stripped, right?
Right. And we were talking about self-regulation. And yes. I think that is a huge piece. So people that have had trauma, one of the biggest impacts is they are unable to self-regulate or self-soothe. So people with trauma often have more issues in relationships. Because if we can self-regulate and self-soothe, if I'm angry, I can actually slow down and take some deep breaths and maybe go take a hot shower and come back and express my feelings instead of just impulsively reacting and yelling.
So what are some tools that you use to teach self-regulation?
Well, there's many. One of the things I talk about is internal and external resources. So internal resources are something that you don't need anyone for. So that might be taking deep breaths or any type of breath work. It might be meditating, praying, maybe taking a hot shower. You know, maybe using some affirmations. And external resources might be like calling a sponsor or going to a meeting or walking on the beach.
Therapist.
Right. So you have to look at like what helps your nervous system. And sometimes people have no idea. And so one of the exercises I give people sometimes is just over the course of a week, tune into your sensory experiences. So sound, sight, touch, smell, just start noticing what gives you pleasure. And don't just notice it, but mindfully pay attention to it and how it affects your body and your nervous system. And that kind of helps people start to develop what could be a resource for them, because it's really different for everyone. Like some people might like a soft blanket, or some people might be soothed by music or the smell of chocolate chip cookies. So I think knowing what speaks to you is really important.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot of things you can do. But like you said, it's just slowing down and being mindful.
Right.
To those situations. I want to kind of touch on the part of sex addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you said there's three phases to sex addiction, but maybe that's jumping ahead. Mm-hmm. I guess is there a definition for sex addiction?
Yeah, I think the definition of addiction in general is that you begin compulsively using a substance or a behavior in order to feel better. And it comes to a point where you are unable to stop despite negative consequences. So I think a lot of times, you know, people tell me they're watching porn. Is that bad? Now, some people have judgments about that. But I don't think it's the behavior that's the problem. I don't think drinking is bad. I don't think watching porn is bad. I don't think having sex with strangers is necessarily bad if that's within your set of values. But what are the costs? And so I think you have to look at what it's costing you. Are there health costs, spiritual costs, relational costs, financial costs? And if you're experiencing multiple costs and you still can't stop, that's when you usually, it's a complex concept to define, but I think that's a pretty good definition. I also think usually because of that, because of not being able to stop despite the consequences, there's usually a lot of shame involved. Mm-hmm. And that becomes cyclical. Shame is an extremely difficult emotion to tolerate. And a lot of addicts can't cope with shame, so they use whatever it is. And then because of their using and inability to stop, they feel more shame, which is intolerable, and hence it becomes a cycle.
So I usually hear more of people have, I would say the common addiction, right, mm-hmm. would be alcohol? Or is that just the most publicized?
I would say the biggest fellowship in terms of recovery definitely is AA. And I would say probably alcohol because it's so accessible. It's something that's mainstream in our society. And so I think it's probably one of the easiest things to abuse. However, with our country's really distorted messages around body image and food and all of that, I think food issues are also becoming a huge problem, both with men and women. You know, there's these messages that you know, you need to look a certain way or be a certain size. And yet we're like the fast food nation, you know? So there's so many there's just so many mixed messages. And I think a lot of times people get their sense of self-worth wrapped up in their body image and their appearance. I mean, especially in LA. So I see a lot of people get sober from alcohol and then develop a food issue or an eating disorder or whatnot. And food is another thing that's really easily accessible.
But under all these addictions, right, is mm-hmm. trauma.
That's my opinion. Some people will say that sometimes it's purely genetic. And I do think genetics play a role. And again, then you get into the nurture nature debate, because if my dad was an alcoholic, did I inherit the alcoholism from him genetically or the way he parented me? So typically when a baby comes into the world, they cannot self-soothe and they need their caregivers to help them learn to self-regulate. And the caregivers become their external regulator until they can learn to self-soothe. So if a parent is not regulated themselves, if they're misattuned to their child's needs, if they're not physically or emotionally available, all this impacts the baby in a way that is traumatic, because the baby is implicitly getting this message that their needs are not important or that they're not valuable. And a lot of times this type of trauma, which is considered developmental or attachment trauma, people don't remember. So what happens is someone never learns to self-soothe, and then they're constantly seeking external regulators in order to self-regulate. And what that means is to be able to feel calm and aligned and at peace in your own body, to be able to regulate your emotions so they're not like huge and out of control. And so, you know, we talked about food. I think for children, and I myself developed an eating disorder at 11 years old. Well, I've had other addictions as well, but that was what it was available to me.
What kind of eating disorder? Well,
I struggled with anorexia at that young age. And for me, it was about control. Like, I don't have any power or control in this family, maybe, but I can control what goes into my body. And it gave me some power. And I think sometimes it's also a way to kind of dissociate, to kind of escape reality. And so often children develop issues with food, because what happens is a child doesn't feel good in their body because their nervous system is dysregulated and they think my body doesn't feel good. And so my body is bad. And so then there's often an attempt to try to control the body. Right. Another common way that children self-regulate or self-soothe maladaptively would be like masturbation. So that's another thing that's easily accessible to them. And sometimes it resolves itself. There's nothing, you know, children don't have that sense of shame. They just explore their bodies. It feels good. It becomes maladaptive when it's excessive and their only coping skill and their only tool to self-regulate. Mm. And so quite frequently people develop other addictions as availability happens. You know, some people start drinking really early because it's accessible, but some people aren't introduced to it until later.
Mm. Yeah. So many fascinating.
You hear people in AA all the time say, when they had their first drink, it was like the clouds parted and the heavens opened and I had arrived. This is how I want to feel all the time. And really it's just a state of feeling okay.
So with the self-soothing mm-hmm. and everyone wanting to be okay, and how that also, you know, I mean, as you mentioned, it just, that's where our addictions come from. Do you think that also, I think we had chatted about this, love is an addiction.
Love can right? certainly be addiction.
You have addiction. Love addiction, sex addiction.
Right. And they're not necessarily the same, but they can coexist. So I work with a lot of love addicts, actually, and a lot of love avoidance. And I would say those are the opposite ends of the spectrum. However, there are many people that are on that spectrum and flip-flop back and forth. But with love addiction, I would say that underlying love addiction is ultimately a fear of abandonment. And so there is this desire to get close and then closer and closer because it feels so euphoric. So typically a love addict, it could be with a friend, it could be with a lover, or partner, they put this person up on a pedestal, and they, because they don't have a solid sense of self, derive meaning about themselves from this person. So if I'm friends with this person, I'll be more popular. If I am married to this man, I'll be more, it'll raise my status. And they fail to see this person as a whole. When we put someone on a pedestal, we're only seeing their positive qualities and we're idealizing them, which is really unfair because there's only a fall that's possible from there.
Right.
And so as the love addict tries to get closer and closer, they often push the person away, and then they start perceiving abandonment, and then they start perhaps engaging in all these behaviors to try, manipulative behaviors to try to reinstate closeness. And ultimately, they either start realizing that this person is a human being with faults, and it's devastating to them. And I would say if the relationship ends, and it could be that the partner breaks up with them, or, you know, they realize that this isn't the person they thought and they end the relationship, it is devastating, like beyond devastating. Usually a love addiction withdrawal is so painful that quite frequently people come into therapy because they're suicidal and they feel like they cannot live without the other person.
All their worth is on that person.
Right, right.
So it kind of goes back to guiding them to themselves.
Right. And really what they're addicted to is the euphoria of that in love feeling.
And that in love feeling. Now, do you know how people talk about that, mm-hmm. like in the start of a relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Does it always go away?
Well, another thing is another love addict pattern might just be to relationship hop. And as soon as it starts getting real, then they're over it because they like that initial in love feeling. Does that always go away? I think so. I think the honeymoon phase only lasts a certain amount of time. And because I don't think it's real, I think it's fantasy. I think that when we first meet someone, we're only showing each other our good sides and we're only being seen.
You're not like, vulnerable.
Only my good points are being seen, which is euphoric. Like this person only sees my good qualities. And as the relationship develops, usually as it becomes more intimate, we again, see people warts and all. And it's so painful when people can see our deepest wounds, but it's so fulfilling when they can love us anyway. And that's where I think the in love feeling starts turning to love. And I think love is a deeper experience.
So would you say the difference, that would be the difference of lust to love? Lust is the beginning phase?
Could be, but you know, you can be love addicted without necessarily having an extreme sexual attraction to a person.
You just want that.
Yeah, the closeness, you know, that feeling of like when I'm with this person, I feel, and that's what's euphoric and that's what's addicting. You might not even be having sex with them or even be that sexually attracted to them. Because you can certainly be love addicted to a friend that's not sexual.
A love addict has abandonment issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is the other one? The avoidance.
So love avoidance. And again, when I'm speaking about this, I'm speaking generally, but it's right. Not for everyone. But love avoidance, sometimes it comes from a typical profile of a love avoidant would be someone who probably maybe had an enmeshed relationship with a parental figure, let's say a mother, and they became the mother's emotional caretaker. And they experienced enmeshment as feeling suffocating. And so the message they got was that love is suffocating. And so their greatest fear is suffocation. The love addict is abandonment. And so they often end up with people that have more love addicted tendencies because they are used to being the caretaker and they get value in being put on a pedestal and being the caretaker. Quite frequently, they're people that can't set boundaries. And so as someone continues to try to get closer and closer, they start feeling suffocated and pulling away. And instead of being able to set the boundary, they might feel a lot of anger and start acting it out. So sometimes they start acting it out by developing a sex addiction or some other addiction, which creates a wall to intimacy. It's like a barrier. And so, you know, it depends what happens. I mean, if they're with someone who's a love addict, it often creates this like explosive dynamic where they're going back and forth. But ultimately, it's about like learning to be able to tolerate intimacy. And so, like, for example, working with love avoidants that are in relationships, you might just suggest they do activities together where it's not so direct, but they learn to tolerate being close with someone without it being direct. So maybe going on hikes together, things like that. But ultimately, it's about learning to set boundaries and to not need to caretake.
Do you think a lot of people, I found this with myself,
mm-hmm.
I have been single for 12, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't think it's because I'm avoiding it. Mm-hmm. I just think there's a certain, I don't feel the need to go out and date all these guys. For mm-hmm. me, I'm like, I know it when I see it and it'll just happen.
I mean, to me, that sounds like a healthy outlook. One of the things I tell my clients that are in maybe Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous or they're dealing with intimacy issues is they want to know when they can date. And what I say is, you know, I think we're ready to date when we are perfectly happy and content not being in a relationship, mm-hmm. where all we know how to make ourselves happy and we feel good about ourselves and we're not coming from a place of need. Now, we might have needs and want to be in a relationship, but it's very different than needing to be in a relationship to complete you or to make you happy. Because when we enter in a relationship from that perspective, the other person feels it and it ends up creating, feeling like a burden or creating dysfunction in a relationship.
Have you heard from people that the way they might see a relationship is not how most people have relationships? And that then creates a lot of, you know, unease with them. I'm talking about myself, just in the sense like I was, you know, again, like I said, I've been alone for so long. So I understand independence.
Right.
And there's something that very scary for almost like a man, like
right.
where if I get close to someone, it's like, how do I still have that independence and I don't become codependent? Right. But then I've noticed I create situations that, I mean, there's a lot of space, like where we don't talk for a week
mm-hmm.
and it's okay. But then I'm like, is it okay? Because everyone's telling me it's not okay. And then I start to mess myself up mm-hmm. and I go, this isn't right. And mm-hmm. then it's almost like I freak out and I've convinced myself this isn't right. But then I'm like, but I don't know how to do that. You know?
Well, one thing I always tell people, if you want a recipe for unhappiness or depression, just start comparing yourselves to other people. But for sure. I think, again, there's no shoulds. I think everybody is different. There might be a little avoidance mm-hmm. in there. I mean, I think love avoidants typically value their independence over closeness. But I don't necessarily think that you're wrong for wanting to be independent or have your space. Again, everybody has their own needs.
Yeah.
And it would be important for you to find someone who is also probably independent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, two love avoidants can be very happy together, but they might not have a very...
it's interesting because I need extreme intimacy.
Yeah, they might not be very connected, but...
No, yeah. So it's
hard if you've been on your own for that long, too, to learn to kind of let down, like maybe let go of some of that independence. Because when you were talking about your fear of codependence, I think there's a level of healthy dependence that is a good thing when we're in relationships.
And what does that look like?
Well, for example, they've done so many studies where when someone is with their partner, their heart rate slows down, they become more calm in their bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in relationships and partnerships, we rely on our partners to do certain things and to be there for us and to meet our needs. And I think ultimately it's healthy to be dependent upon someone else. But in the context of healthy dependence versus not being able to function on your own or needing that person to complete you or give you an identity.
Fine line. It's a
yeah,
fine line.
It is.
So then let's talk about open relationships.
Okay.
Why? That's the wrong word to use. Well, I guess for me, I've always wondered, and it's not, I don't want to make somebody who has it right or wrong. I guess I don't understand it so much of like, why would you be committed to somebody, but have somebody you see on the side? And how do you do that and have real intimacy? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
That's a really good question. And especially in our culture, I think it's people are really uncomfortable with it because we are a culture that has been created around Christianity and the idea of the institution of marriage and commitment and fidelity. That being said, I think as we're progressing as a society, I think many people are shifting how they view relationships, how they view marriage. And is it better? You know, affairs have been happening since the beginning of time. So is this a way to mitigate betrayal and dishonesty? I do see so many couples that have opened up their marriages. And I will say it is very, very difficult and risky. I would say most of the time, granted, I'm working with couples that are coming in for help, It gets really tricky. And I think one of the key points to making it, I guess, as smooth as possible is being very, very clear about what your boundaries are and respecting each other's boundaries. So, for example, maybe we have an open relationship, but you're not kissing this person or having sex with this person. Or maybe we have an open sexual relationship, but I don't want you seeing this person when I'm not there. I mean, and to each their own, everyone has differences in what they feel comfortable with. And it could open a conversation to really increase vulnerability and connectedness. Again, I bring up Esther Perel because I love her, but she talks about that a lot in Mating in Captivity, about how we often become emotionally almost enmeshed with a partner after years of being with them, and it feels safe and secure, but there's not a lot of novelty, and we are attracted to people like to other, right? We're not attracted to ourselves. And so I think that there is sometimes that novelty is lost when we become too close and safe with each other. And so I think that sometimes people open up their marriage for that reason. So I definitely think it can work. I think it's risky. I think it requires a lot of healthy communication, boundary setting, and trust.
Do you think, I was talking to somebody else about this, and a guy was telling me that he cheated, or he almost got divorced twice. Mm-hmm. And he said he cheated. He asked for an open relationship. She didn't want any of this. And he said he realized he was running from his trauma. Mm. And when he wasn't, when it would come up, he would want to leave them. He would want to go outside of the marriage. Mm-hmm. And once he started going within, All those feelings went away for women.
Well, it's interesting because I do think often, not always, many sex addicts are love avoidant And they can't tolerate intimacy. So they may love their wife, but not be able to tolerate true intimacy. And so like a maladaptive way of getting their need met is by going and having sex or acting out sexually with other people, because it creates a false sense of intimacy, but it never fills the void. And so the need is insatiable.
And with that said,
and it creates a block, right? So as I said, like often love avoidance who can't tolerate intimacy will create a wall of intimacy by engaging in another addictive or compulsive behavior. So that was a way that maybe he couldn't tolerate intimacy. And so he was creating a wall by engaging in a behavior with someone else.
And now that he is like going for it, he's like, wow, this is like pretty great, right?
Well, it sounds like first he needed to find intimacy with himself, so that he could be available to a partner. Yeah.
And that whole thing when you were talking about, just finding intimacy in other ways, I know you've brought up before, would you say it's more men, the intimacy with, they find it through porn or social media, like a false sense of that's what?
I would say if you look at the statistics and numbers, I would say there are more male sex addicts and porn addicts, but certainly not all. I actually did a lecture on female porn addiction at the sex addiction conference in Arizona last year. It is definitely on the rise as well, because there's so many different reasons that people are becoming more attracted to porn these days, especially because it's so easily accessible and free. And so, you know, there are many women who struggle with that as well. I just think the numbers are much lower.
And you can take that all back, right, to basically what you said in the beginning of They're just trying to feel safe and soothed.
Mm-hmm. I think frequently women tend, I mean, there's probably women have more of a tendency towards love addiction with sexual acting out. Or a lot of times women use food as a way to have nurturing, right? Mm.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not all women either. I mean, men definitely do the same. But if we're looking at patterns and statistics, I think those are more commonalities.
Would you say that like maybe 99% of people have something like a vice, like anything? It could be simple as, you know, I would say mine is I would reach more for caffeine.
Mm-hmm. I would say the majority of people do, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the vice becomes compulsive and one step further, addictive, right? So for example, if I have a bad day, I might want to come home and eat ice cream. Nothing wrong with that. You know, I take my child to go get ice cream maybe when she has a bad day or something like that. Yeah. But if every time I have a bad day, I need to get ice cream, then it's becoming compulsive. And then sometimes that compulsive behavior can become an addiction when we're unable to stop despite the consequences.
Yeah, that's great. So how would you say, how do we fall in love?
The biggest question.
Yes. How do we do it?
Well, I think there's so many different things that are involved in falling in love. And a lot of it is happening neurochemically. I think when we are falling in love, there's a lot of endorphins that are released. And so a lot of it is happening in our brain. But I think, again, to truly fall in love, I think we have to reach a place where we can feel okay in our own skin and that we can be okay with ourselves so that we're not needing the other person to complete us or define us. So having a solid sense of self and also being able to self-regulate is huge, because if we can't, then it's really difficult to tolerate that intimacy. It's hard to be comfortable in our own skin. And so a lot of it has to do with being emotionally present and available. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly why we're attracted to certain people. I think attraction is a big part of it. I don't necessarily think it's always physical attraction. It might be we're attracted to someone's mind mm-hmm. or their voice or something mm-hmm. like that. But I do think part of it is just we're animals. And part of it is that, you know, might be our smells. There's so many different factors.
Mm. Yeah. And do you, from a therapist point of view, do you have I don't want to say if it's a judgment or not, but if you hear somebody say, like there's couples, there's people who meet somebody, you have that classic case, they meet, they're together all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, he's amazing. I love her. Da, da, da. Mm-hmm. But it blows up, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, that's really common.
Do you feel one works better than the other?
In terms of like it being quick or slow?
Yeah, like almost like real. Like, do you feel that there's something like a pattern or there's like when you get together and you need to be together all the time mm-hmm. or maybe you want to be? Mm-hmm. I don't know. For me, I'm like, ooh, like that's a red flag.
Yeah. Well, I think it's different for everyone again. Yeah. And that might work for some people. I definitely know couples who met and immediately were kind of in that euphoric in love stage, uh-huh. wanted to be together all the time. And the relationship ended up working out.
Oh, wow.
And they got married. But it doesn't mean they were in that phase forever.
Got it.
I definitely think it's something to be cautious about when someone comes in saying, oh my God, I found the one, we've been together every day this week. Just because I think moderation is the key. And often when we are, that tends to seem like a little bit of an addictive behavior. So mm-hmm. again, I think it's just important as my role just to help them kind of slow down and examine. But for example, when someone is in Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous and they're working with a sponsor and doing the steps, they might be prescribed to take 90 days with no dating or no relationships, no flirting, whatever their specific issues are. And when they are ready to date, they're often given a dating plan. And the dating plan is very specific because I think the idea of the dating plan is it helps build healthy intimacy. Mm. So the dating plan might involve No texting, except for logistics. No phone conversations longer than 30 minutes. No going over to each other's house until you've been dating at least 30 days or you've had this amount of dates. So it really helps people have some boundaries, because I think boundaries are really important in relationships, both to protect ourselves, but also having containment boundaries. So if I'm angry with you, I'm not just going to punch you in the face, because I can contain my feelings and emotions and behavior. Mm-hmm. And so it's about both being able to contain ourselves and set boundaries to protect ourselves.
That's awesome. That's good. I mean,
and when we rush into it so quickly, you know, we're opening ourselves up to vulnerability, and we haven't gotten to know each other yet. So we're just setting ourselves up to get hurt because we're becoming so vulnerable. And then as we get to know each other, it might not work out.
Yeah.
So I think the concept of getting to know each other slowly as you build that intimacy helps create more of a foundation.
And as a married woman, do you feel it gets easier being vulnerable when you practice, or, you know?
Yes and no. I think, Yes, certainly I feel like I can share any of my feelings with my husband, but I also think there's layers. So I think the more intimate you get, there's more layers that are shed, and sometimes that's painful. I think you go deeper into what you're willing to share and expose, but I also think that's also such deep inner work for yourself, right? Yeah. And so I definitely think relationships are a big teacher for us.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, so much knowledge. You are just so knowledgeable.
Well, thank you.
I'm so excited that you came and talked with me.
Yeah, well, I think you have great questions. I really enjoy speaking with you. So this was a great opportunity.
Yay, thank you. And where can people find you?
I'm on Instagram at Lauren Dummett and Facebook, Lauren Dummett Shock. And I also have a website. It's www.triunetherapy.com. And that is T-R-I-U-N-E.
Awesome. Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like based on your credentials, anything that anyone is looking for, they could come to you and...
Well, definitely. And if it's not in my wheelhouse, I certainly know a multitude of professionals that have very specific expertise. So I'm happy to help someone get the specific help they need. Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's it for today's podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. Please let me know what you think. Leave a comment, share, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.